I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. Today, we're going to celebrate the life and career of a rock and roll giant, Charlie Watts, the drummer for the Rolling Stones for 6 decades, died on August 24th at the age of 80. And it was kind of a shock to everyone. We knew that he was taking a leave from the upcoming Stones tour for a medical issue, but no one expected this, and I think everyone's just taking it in. It's a huge loss. We have with us Rob Sheffield and Hank Stemer, who are going to talk a little bit about Charlie's legacy. But first, let's hear from a couple of his peers. Here's a bit of an interview I did with Max Weinberg, of course, the drummer for the E Street Band, and a friend of Charlie's, shortly after he heard the news.
I have a beautiful note from Keith that he wrote after he read The Big Beat, where he references Charlie, you know, and I'm feeling for Keith, because there are many, myself included, many would-be Charlie Watts-type drummers, but there was only, and there will ever only be one Charlie Watts. Hmm. And rest in peace, and, you know, I can tell you this, on board the song Born in the USA, when Bruce pulled out that riff, I went right to Street Fighting, man.
Right.
And I've been listening to it a lot that day. You know, we were recording the album Born in the USA, and when I was laying down that drum part, I'm thinking, okay, I'm Charlie Watts. I'm going to do my best Charlie Watts. Even to the little eighth note, bop, 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 which is right off of Street Fighting, man.
Hmm.
So I'm recalling him fondly, but I'm, you know, not long ago, last time I tweeted, we lost Roger Hawkins.
Yeah.
Who was a friend of mine. You know, all the guys in the book became deep friends, and, you know, words can't express what Charlie Watts meant to me as an individual, and certainly as an icon of music, and not just in rock. And he was a wonderful artist, too. You know, he was a wonderful graphic designer and artist. And just, here's another quick story, but the day I interviewed him was at his apartment in on the river in London, and 1981, and Ian Stewart was the reason I got that interview in 1980, 81. He set it up. I'm not quite sure how I got to Ian Stewart, but he set it up with Charlie, and I was their guest at the Arms concert at the Royal Albert Hall. So, you know, Ian Stewart, who knew everybody, he took me under his wing. So I felt like, you know, I felt like royalty, you know. Anyway, so I go to his apartment, and Shirley, his wife, wasn't feeling well that day. So he was so attentive to her, bringing her ice, bringing her drinks. He kept interrupting. And I have this all on tape. Bringing, you know, interrupting. I must see after Shirley. And he'd go into the bedroom. But he gave me, you know, an incredible interview. And, you know, when we talked about these, you know, Panama Francis or the drummers that he admired, you know, there was a kinship. And, you know, I know how close Steve Jordan was with him. And anyone who ever came in his orbit, you know, he'd be standing backstage in his Rolling Stones logo tracksuit, twirling his sticks, having a conversation with drummers and people in the drum industry who would come to pay their respects to him. And he was always so gracious. And the one story my family was involved with that is just priceless, and it comes up every once in a while. They played Madison Square Garden, I think, I forget what tour it was, but he invited us, and my kids were old enough, you know, Jay now, of course, is rock's greatest drummer, according to Modern Drummer.
Mm.
He was, you know, he was a teenager, he was probably 13 or 12. We go to see him, and there's like a receiving line to meet, to say hello to Charlie in New York, and he has a tent backstage, his own tent. So we finally, you know, there were maybe 30 people, we get up there. And you're ushered in by his manager, a wonderful woman named Sherry Daly. And, you know, he's going to go on. But for the 4 minutes, 4 or 5 minutes we're with him, you're the only person that exists in the world. And he always wore his blue Rolling Stone tongue logo windbreaker. And then, and we're talking, and I, you know, my son's learning how to play the drums, and the first thing he said was, "Well, you know, your father and I love Buddy Rich. You must study Buddy Rich." And he goes, "Oh, Mr. Watts, I know Buddy Rich." And but then Charlie took my hand to shake it, and in classic British understatement, he said, "So, where are you off to now?" Which was like, it's time for the next people. It was the classiest brush off. And by the way, myself and Jay have both used that.
And David Brown of Rolling Stone talked to Patrick Carney of the Black Keys to get a bit of a tribute to Charlie Watts, and let's hear that.
You got to play with them on stage, and you got to do some dual drumming with Charlie almost 10 years ago.
I think it's the only time I've ever done that.
Well, start with, do you grow up a Stones fan, and as a drummer, can you just speak to, was he an influence on you, and what made him special?
When I was a kid, I was allowed to watch, shit I probably shouldn't be allowed to, and so there was a show about Vietnam called Tour of Duty.
Okay.
When I was about 7, 1987, the closing theme song to the show was Paint It Black. I was like, this is the coolest fucking song, as a really little kid, and watching, really crazy Vietnam shows. And but my dad would make me tapes with Stones, but that one song just always stuck out, as a kid. And, of course, as I got older, got into music for real and just got past the Vanilla Ice and things like that. The Stones were one of the, Beatles, Stones, first couple bands I really knew a lot about. And it's weird. It's like today, of course, I listen back and what I heard was I play drums I try to play drums like Charlie Watts. I don't try to play like John Bonham or Phil Ward. I try to play like Charlie.
Yeah, when you say play like him, what was it about his feel or whatever?
The thing is that, the feel of the Stones is like a hard kind of stomp. It's just constantly into the backbeat and there's no bullshit, And I think, look at a song like Brown Sugar, right, where it's like he's playing the four tom, throughout the verses, and he goes to the hi-hat and lifts the song, and just like the very simple, natural. It's just a natural thing. And just like what I remember about playing with the Stones, aside from getting to meet them and little moments with being on stage, looking up and seeing, Keith Richards and Ronnie Wood and Mick Jagger, and then looking over, and I kind of hit this flub note, like it's a 4/4 stomp, 4/4 song we did, this Bo Diddley song. So it's like, it's basically like, I didn't mess it up, you can't really mess it up, but I turned the snare beat around or something, and Charlie, I looked at Charlie, and he looked at me with this big, huge smile, and he knew what I had done, and he just thought it was so funny.
Did the other guys shoot you different looks? Compared to Charlie?
No, unless you were a drummer, you wouldn't know what was happening. And also, that's the cool thing about the Stones is that the feel about the Stones has always been about trying to find this kind of American swagger. This, I guess stomp is the word, but I was listening to some recordings they did with Ry Cooder, and it's just all about the feel. And, it's like from, Keith Richards, his guitar playing is kind of like technically sloppy, but if he played it any better, they wouldn't sound like the Stones. And it's just the way that Charlie kind of just sits in there, and it's like, it's no frills, but it is just, he's right on top of the sound, he is like the backbone. I mean, if you're not a drummer and you're not used to into the nuance of what's happening in the swing and the beat, it's hard to appreciate.
Were there certain songs you listened back to today
I think when you start hearing the Stones play with Steve Jordan, you're instantly be able to tell that Charlie's gone. Steve's a great drummer, but there's just something slightly sloppy, but really musical. It's just, it's like, he's not thinking when he's playing. You know what I'm saying?
Right. He had an almost like a light touch in a way. Like you said, it wasn't John Bonham.
Oh no, it was all swing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and most people I know who aren't drummers, the first thing they mention is they notice that he doesn't hit the hi-hat sometimes when he hits the snare drum or something. But, I think that if you listen to the beat on Satisfaction, you know, it's kind of like a, it's like a derivative of a Motown beat or something, but it is just, it's so, so fucking simple. But I don't know if it had been really applied to rock and roll prior to that, you know, and so that it's also the Paint It Black beat. And it's also the beat to, you know, hundreds and hundreds of rock and roll songs afterwards.
Right. So. Which Stone songs did you grow up learning to play in the drum part? Like Paint It Black, for example, since you had heard
I've never learned to play a song on the drums, technically. Like,
okay.
I sit around with headphones on, like, I've got to figure this fill out. You know what I mean? I sat around with Dan being like, it would be cool if we had a band that could make you write songs. So when we would try to do covers, we would sit there and learn to play it together, maybe reference something. But I never really tried to learn
verbatim
the beat.
Yeah.
But I do know that in the studio, you know, like Satisfaction beat's definitely been a touchstone.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
Again, we're paying tribute today to a rock and roll giant, Charlie Watts of the Rolling Stones, died August 24th at the age of 80, and I have with me to talk about his life and his legacy and his playing, Hank Steamer and Rob Sheffield. Thanks for joining me, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Hank, let's start with you. I mean, you're a great person to have with us today as our resident actual drummer and also something of an expert in jazz, which is something that Charlie drew on extensively. That was what he loved, was jazz and jazz drummers. Maybe just talk a little bit about what Charlie took from jazz, his roots in jazz, and some of the drummers who influenced them and how they influenced him.
Yeah, well, you know, just listening back to the interviews over the past few days, you know, jazz was, and I got this a little bit from Chad Smith of the Red Hot Chili Peppers when I talked to him, because he had interviewed Charlie back in 2018. But really, if anyone seemingly sat down and talked to Charlie Watts about music, about anything, he would always direct the conversation back to jazz. And it wasn't just sort of like a name-checking thing. Like, his knowledge went incredibly deep. You know, he talked to Chad about how Chico Hamilton on the early Jerry Mulligan recordings was a big influence. He talked about, you know, Miles Davis, Benny Goodman, you know, Charlie Parker constantly. I mean, he was like a real head. He talked about how a friend, his friend and he used to sort of sit around and, like, you know, they had the credits memorized on the Louis Armstrong Hot 5 and Hot 7 recordings. This was the, you know, the kind of the soil that he came out of, like, as a fan. And you know, Rob mentioned in his great tribute that his engagement with rock and roll was just sort of not, you know, that's not where he was coming from at the time that he entered the Stones. But I think that Charlie Watts, you know, I think there's a, you know, it's often said with so many of these rock drummers of this generation, I think it's often said that these people are coming out of jazz. And I think you can say this out of so many people, whether that's Ginger Baker, who's like a rough contemporary, or someone like, you know, Bill Ward or Bill Bruford or John Bonham. I mean, it's a whole generation of British rock drummers who are coming out of jazz. I think it's interesting, though, to look at, like, you know, what they took out of it. And I think that someone like Ginger Baker, who was obviously a super, like, flamboyant player, you know, very interested in, like, you know, playing solos and just really, like, kind of being out front in a way that maybe a drummer like a Buddy Rich would be, or an Art Blakey, or one of these type of jazz drummers. I think that it's not so simple to say that Charlie Watts is just, like, straight up coming out of jazz, because it's more like, you know, what school or mindset of jazz, you know, because the fact that he cited Chico Hamilton on these Jerry Mulligan records is very telling. Chico Hamilton, you know, a West Coast drummer who's very known for sort of tasteful, understated playing. I've also heard Charlie Watts shout out Paul Motion of the early Bill Evans trio, and very much these drummers who were very comfortable in an accompanying role. and essentially being background musicians, and that not being like an insult or sort of second class, but just literally that was their function in the band. Charlie Watts often talked about how he, you know, being a drummer, it's like he wasn't going to sit around and play drums by himself. You know what I'm saying? Like he was very comfortable with the idea of accompanying. And he often said he had no interest in playing drum solos. So I think that you do hear jazz in Charlie Watts, but it's almost like in this very subtle shading. You're not going to hear him playing like ting, ting, to ting, you know, traditional jazz rhythm, like the way you might hear Ginger Baker peppering that in with Cream, these long like improvisational excursions. Like Charlie Watts is essentially a pop drummer working in like a backbeat format, and he was very committed to the like art and craft of a backbeat. And Rob, I know you quoted that amazing quote from Charlie where he was talking about how rock music is dance music. To him, like, it wasn't a progressive music. It wasn't really about, you know, to him, jazz represented a progressive music. Rock, more example, you know, represented kind of laying in the pocket and just kind of laying it down. And I think that his art was really laying it down and also making it feel as I know that Daryl Jones, the longtime bassist for the Stones, has referred to like a swagger that he brought to it. And to me, like, that's where the jazz comes in. It's not like you're going to hear jazz figures in his playing. You're going to hear like a sensibility to executing a backbeat and making it feel, just giving it that sort of human feeling that is, you know, it's like you could have a drum machine playing behind the Rolling Stones and, you know, some people might not notice it, but you need that little, he puts some sort of like a, I guess I would say like almost like a grease on it. There's like a slight little accent that he puts on the backbeat that makes it just feel good at whatever tempo he was playing. And I think to me, that's the jazz in Charlie Watts.
Well said. I think Max Weinberg in a different interview pointed out that Al Jackson, the Stax Volt drummer, was one of the guys who popularized this thing that's so essential to what we think of as groove, is this laying back on the backbeat, which is literally playing the two and the four of every bar. You're playing it milliseconds after where a metronome would play it, right? And so that's where a lot of the swing comes from. That's where a lot of the feel comes from. And that's a huge thing that Charlie Watts tended to do, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I was listening to Kay Hear Me Knocking earlier and thinking about how the beat to that, it's just to the point where it would be late if he hit the snare any later on that kind of like halftime, like beautiful halftime groove on that. And I think you hear a lot of this in Ringo Starr too. I mean, this is what we think of when we think of like that generation of British drummers. That's why we love the feel of these players, especially those two, because they're like the backbeat sort of kings. But yeah, absolutely. I think that it's all about like laying back and really, you know, how do you drive the band while also somehow seeming relaxed? And I think that was what everyone marveled at with Charlie Watts. Like when watching it, how could he be so unflappable in the midst of this kind of like very like charged up atmosphere? It's almost like he like centered the thing with his personality somehow. And Rob, I know you've written about, you know, just his blatantly seeming unimpressed by like the circus of the Stones or whatever, or kind of the peacock nature of Mick Jagger or something like that. It's just like this, it was evident in his personality, and it was like he just kept everything on an even keel, which again has nothing to do with like what a Ginger Baker would do or something like that, who would be all about sort of like providing his own kind of like thunderous commentary and really, you know, charging ahead. And Watts is like, no, I'm gonna like keep this baseline, and you can kind of like set a watch by it, you know?
Totally. I remember reading an interview where Charlie Watts said that when he was on stage with the Stones, he would fantasize in his head that he was Elvin Jones, and that he would just be pretending he was Elvin Jones on stage, which is such a mind-blowing thing. It blew my mind to read that as a teenager, because I thought everybody else is fantasizing about being Charlie Watts. But to him, he was like, this is okay, but it's not Elvin Jones.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. And again, like these interviews, when he was talking to Chad Smith or many of the other ones, like he's talking about having, like he's collecting Tony Williams ride cymbals or Mel Lewis's like, you know, green sparkle drum kit and putting them in a warehouse. And even he is saying like, I don't even know why I have this stuff. I don't even know what I intend to do with it. It's just more that like, he was so enamored of that art form. And in a way, Rob, like, as you pointed out, that he just didn't seem to be with rock and roll. Like Rocky almost, it was almost dismissive, like the way that he would talk about it, you know, like in this whole thing about, you know, I think that quote was progression was Miles Davis playing, you know, modal jazz. You can't do that in rock or something. And it's like, it's amazing that this, like, not being impressed with that idiom was somehow what allowed him to be, to excel in it or something.
Totally. Because he, I mean, that really kind of sums it up, that he became the greatest of rock and roll drummers because he was aspiring to something. So it kept him from being unself-conscious about it. I mean, a lot of, like, what you said about that generation of British players being often very jazz influenced, sometimes in ways that were really kind of showy and silly, you know, like a lot of, like, the British musicians from that generation would do something like cover Pork Pie Hat on a record or something like that as a, yes, I've listened to these records, kind of like flashing their cards of credit. Whereas, like, Charlie Watts never did anything like that on stage or on a record. He was very focused. It's almost like the way you're describing it, what he took from jazz is almost like an ethic, you know, a code of, you know, a jazz drummer does this, serves this. It's not about getting attention.
Yeah. And when you saw him play, like I was just watching a clip. I think he was on like the Dennis Miller Show with his jazz quintet in like the 90s. And it's incredible because he was always name checking people like Tony Williams, like these super progressive type of jazz drummers. When you saw him play jazz, it just sounded like 1950 or even earlier. You know what I mean? Like he's just sitting there very gently, like playing, you know, he was very happy in the accompanying role in those contexts as well. He's sitting here playing brushes behind Bernard Fowler singing like Loverman or something like that. And also there was that amazing, he had this orchestra in the 80s, which I was sort of unfamiliar with until recently, but he sort of stocked it with all these jazz musicians and there were actually three drummers in it. And he's kind of just like sitting back and letting John Stevens, who's this really known as this like free jazz, free improv drummer, like basically play their leading role. And even in that context where it has his name on it, he's just like almost, you have to really pay attention to even remember that Charlie Watts is sitting there. It's really remarkable how self-effacing he could be, you know?
It's interesting to read interviews with him, including the previously unpublished Michael Gilmore interview that we posted on RollingStone.com, which I recommend. You know, the extent to which Keith specifically introduced Charlie to a lot of this music that meant everything to making Keith. He made him sort of listen to Elvis Presley as a musician, which he had heard Elvis like everyone else in his generation, but he hadn't really been paying attention to it that way, paying attention to DJ Fontana or whoever's playing and what was good about it. And it seems like Keith in that way. And, you know, if you ever, you can talk to Stones and all of them have that record collector geek side to them, which is so fascinating. You know, I know that I've talked about this before, but you know, you just start Mick talking about blues harmonica and all of a sudden this entirely different person emerges where he's just literally geeking out. And it's so extraordinary. And that's who they were. They were, you know, toting these records, but Mick and Keith were toting different records. And in the way that your friend, you know, it's like, it might not be your core thing, but it's the thing that your friend teaches you about and you do learn it. That's how he learned the rock and roll stuff, and I think probably even the Chess record stuff came from Keith, you know, and he did, of course, learn and respect that stuff. It just wasn't like his core stuff, which is very interesting to me. Rob, I wonder if you could just talk about Charlie as the persona as well, just like the character of Charlie Watts that we got to know over six decades.
Well, he was someone who famously was married to the same woman for 57 years while being a member of the Rolling Stones. That combination is so much cognitive dissonance, and even the other Stones were really kind of blown away by it. I mentioned in my tribute a fantastic 1981 cover story on Keith interview, and the question is, do you and the Stones, do you hang out when you're not making music together? You know, do you see each other socially? And Keith's only response to that is to start talking about Charlie and how he gets to how Charlie visits every couple of months. He doesn't mention anybody else in the band or even notice that they might be, you know, like obviously the interviewer's hoping he's got some Mick and Keith hanging out off the clock stories. And Keith cannot stop talking about Charlie and how much he wants Charlie to approve of him. And that was always some of the fascinating things, that all the other Stones were competing with each other to be Charlie's favorite. So there's, you know, that beautiful dynamic that, you know, I always love whenever Mick would put out a solo album and people would attack it and Keith would say something really funny and nasty in public about how terrible the latest Mick solo album was. And Mick's retort was always, well, Charlie liked it. And it was almost like that was the court of final opinion that they could all agree to. And you could really tell Mick did not care whether Keith liked these records. He only worried about whether Charlie said that he liked them. And Keith only worried about what Charlie thought of him as a musician or a person. He had that mystique that was so intimidating to the other Stones. And nobody ever intimidated the Rolling Stones. And that was part of the Charlie mystique. And for those of us who, you know, were MTV kids and we grew up seeing the Stones videos, you know, like Start Me Up, a classic one, Hang Fire, another classic one. You know, Mick is out front, like prancing away geniusly. Keith and Ronnie are posing. And, you know, Bill Wyman is in the back rolling his eyes. And there's these funny moments during those videos where Mick turns away from the camera and you can see it and tries to make eye contact with Charlie just to get a facial expression out of him. And it's funny how it just does not work. There's, you know, a couple moments in the Start Me Up video where Charlie's like, oh my God, you want a facial expression? Fine, fine, I'll try. But it's a thing that's not what he did. And that's kind of goes back to the sort of the jazz code that Hank was talking about, that, you know, he was a working musician, not a star. And I think that's part of the reason that his death is hitting everybody so hard. I'm always surprised people are saying so much that I didn't expect that this would affect me the way it did. But Charlie epitomized the working musician. You know, I was really excited to see him back on the road, back with the Stones. I was more excited about my next Stone show than my first one. With Charlie, there was always a sense he was a working musician. He was in it for the long haul. And, you know, I wanted to hear him next time. I was curious about the work he still had ahead of him.
I mean, you know, stating the obvious, but we just hadn't lost a member of the Rolling Stones for quite some time.
Since the 60s.
Yeah, so there's just a broader thing about that. It's just, I mean, everyone understood that we're talking about an 80-year-old man, and even, you know, had he stayed healthy and around, there was going to be a finite limit of how, of no one had ever been a rock and roll drummer into their 80s. It just hasn't been done. So he was already pushing the physical limits of this thing. And it's, and that's worth talking about as well. I mean, one of the things that the other guys in the band, because I did all these Stones interviews over the years, and I don't think I ever talked to Charlie once. He didn't talk. But what they would say about him is that he was in pain after the shows in the later years. Like, he was, you know, he would have to ice himself down at best, and that all that effortlessness was actually a lot of effort. But, you know, the other thing is, and Hank, you could probably speak to this, is that drummers have always said to me, I remember Trey Cool from Green Day and other people saying that the only way that you can keep going is to be more like Charlie Watts as far as playing correctly and not trying to destroy the drum kit and just getting yourself into a proper way of playing as possible, or else you're hopeless. So there was that. I mean, I think his jazz trained sort of approach allowed him to keep going beyond what many drummers could ever manage, right?
Yeah, I mean, he didn't smash the drums, you know what I mean? Like, and I think that that's, again, I mean, just think about all the contemporaries and just sort of like what became of them, you know, like whether it's Keith Moon or Bonham or whoever. I mean, he was, you know, and also you can look at the size of his kit too. I mean, I think that's an obvious thing that's easy to overlook. I mean, he's sitting there playing just a little four-piece kit. Like, he never sort of, you know, felt the need to fill the stage up with that. And it wasn't an athletic display with him. You know what I mean? And drumming is, you know, there's a theatrical element of it, you know, and I mean, you could speak of Bonham, you could speak of like Dave Grohl, whoever, but I think people in general, they like to see a drummer like sort of kicking the crap out of the kid. And that's a fun thing to watch. But Charlie, you know, he took a different path. He would often talk about like a player like Joe Morello, the Dave Brubeck drummer. And I think if you look at clips of like a player like that, who it was about like the sophistication and the finesse. And that's what's exciting about watching a Joe Morello, as opposed to, and Rob, it's really interesting. You say Elvin Jones, who is, you know, was a hard, like a really hard hitting player, and kind of, you know, had a very like deep, like rumbling sound. And Charlie was just much more streamlined. I've just been sort of like A-B-ing a lot of the early Stones, like, you know, 70s stuff, and then kind of flashing forward to like 80s, 90s beyond. And just thinking about, you know, there's all these, like we said, there's all these sort of paradoxes about this guy. But the thing that keeps striking me is this, somebody whose rhythmic sensibilities are coming out of like the 40s and 50s. and then who's playing these like very streamlined backbeats that made a lot of sense, like let's say in the 60s, and then somehow this rhythmic language translates completely to like almost a disco feel on something like Miss You. And again, I'm sure you too can cite a lot of other examples of just somehow the same Charlie Watts rhythm made sense in these later times without really much of an adjustment at all. Like, how is that possible?
I think part of it is just his very lack of attachment to rock and roll as a thing meant that he saw himself as just as sort of a drummer, as a professional drummer. And if the style's shifting a little bit, the same way a big band drummer might shift to the next thing because you're a working musician, I think it was part of that mentality. It's not, I mean, it's only if you're very into yourself, right? I think that you would refuse to shift styles and listen to what people are doing and move. If you thought of yourself as this, you know, as some monster of rock who does their thing and won't do anything else, then it might be harder. But I think he was just, I think he had ears and was just willing and interested to adapt. I saw him talking in one of the interviews about the Meters, not a disco band, but that came well after, you know, his formative years, but he was obviously listening very closely to that. So I think that's a lot of it. Rob, how do you see it?
Well, definitely. I mean, he was always part of it is just the marvel that the Stones, especially in the 80s, when all the other bands of their generation were making all the mistakes that the Stones weren't making at that time. Everybody was getting really into overdubs and textures and super over-processing their sound in lots of ways. And Charlie was always committed to forward momentum. He was always making it propulsive and percussive. And that's why when you listen to the Stones, and, you know, if you were listening in 1981 compared to, you know, new records by other like top tier rock bands that year, the Stones were the ones who were like, let's make everything faster. Let's keep it lean and mean, focused on the groove, focused on Charlie. You know, Emotional Rescue, a great example of an album where they have almost no songs, because songs would just get in Charlie's way.
I love this concept of yours that they had to reach a level where to get the songs out of the way to allow Charlie to come to the forefront.
Yes, and they couldn't do, you know, like, a, you know, on some girls they have big statement songs, you know, like, you know, Before They Make Me Run, something like that. I mean, Emotional Rescue, the song itself, which the weirdness of that cannot be overestimated. That is just Mick and Charlie in the studio messing around. Mick's on a keyboard, Charlie's on the drums, and they make this up for comedy. Like, they think it's funny. It's after hours. Maybe a refreshment of some sort has been consumed by one or more of them. But they were not writing a song. And I remember somebody asked Charlie about playing it live. He said, you can't do something like that twice. You know, it wasn't even a song, but it became a number one hit. It's the kind of thing that when they didn't have anything else, they could always lean on Charlie. And so there were entire records, you know, Black and Blue, another great example where they showed up, they had no songs. They were just basically like, Charlie, you know, you do some cool Charlie stuff and we will fill in the spaces around you. And they could always make a great record that way. Some of my favorite Stones records are the ones where they don't have any songs. They're just like, Charlie, you just take this one.
It's so funny, Rob, because I put on Black and Blue for a second and the first song, Hot Stuff. I mean,
there's two words in that song. Hot stuff.
Speaking of the Meters, my God, like he just went into a Meters thing. So there you go. I mean, he was, you know, he kept listening.
Like Hand of Fate on that record, which, you know, it's, you know, he's like, I'm going to do a country kind of shuffle. And it's, you know, and of course it's very Charlie-ized. You wouldn't listen to it and think of it as a country song. I think he was listening to Lynyrd Skynyrd when, you know, when he came up with that beat. The Hand of Fate is on the now. There's no song per se. There's no chorus, no, like, it's they're basically responding to this Charlie groove with this kind of collection of musical ideas. And it's just fascinating to hear how he could inspire the whole band that way.
Hank, there's this peculiarity of Charlie's playing that people point to. It's almost a cliche to point it to it, but I guess he didn't play the hi-hat at the same moment when he played the snare. He would always stop playing the hi-hat, which is a very strange thing to do. And the fact that it didn't screw with his groove is very interesting to me. It makes no sense to me because that's the first, I mean, if you're at the most basic level, if you're keeping eighth notes on the hi-hat and then you're hitting on the backbeat, that's just how you play. But he did this weird thing. What's the deal with that? What do you make of that?
Yeah, I've been puzzling over that a lot. I've also been listening to the records closely, and it's not on all the records. Like, there are definitely some of the earlier, like the 70s stuff, you can listen, and that hi-hat is going, and he's not sort of pulling his hand away, as you can see. There's actually some really... The footage that I keep going back to is on that the Martin Scorsese documentary, that Shine a Light. There was, and I don't know where this comes from, but there are these sort of drum cam clips, which I would encourage anyone to check out. I've just been, I wish the whole show was like that, because I would really love to watch him do that. But in terms of that thing you're asking about, and Questlove pointed out to he talked to Corey Groh, our colleague, a fascinating tribute from Questlove, but I cannot sit here and tell you like what the effect of that is. It's more just like a visual quirk. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know how much like sonic effect that actually has, because you can see him kind of miming his right hand on the hi-hat as though he were going to hit it, but he pulls it away. And it's just one of these strange sort of little kind of quirks of him that makes him like kind of a very like human player, even while he's in some ways he had a metronomic quality, but it's just another little like quirk of his humanity. And I think that just that simple quirk really gets at the fact that, and this is also kind of a cliche, but I think it's worth pointing out, drumming is just like everything else, is becoming so much more quantized, drummers mimicking a drum machine and not embracing the idiosyncrasies. And if you watch that Shine a Light footage and kind of see, like, you know, his fills sometimes sound a little bit rushed. He can do these little like kind of almost slightly frantic sounding, like little snare breaks or little slight hits on the tom. His playing could sound a little bit wobbly sometimes, and not in a bad way, but just human. And that Daryl Jones interview I was talking about, he was talking about, you know, you could hear a wedding band play the Stones and they might hit it right on. You need that twist in it. And it's hard to say where that comes from. You know, that quirk of the hi-hat, is it that? Is it just like this slightly unpolished feel? Like, it's hard to know where it comes from, but he kept that humanity in the playing. And like you said, I think that's what the other musicians were really responding to and relying on.
One thing I'm curious about, and I haven't seen anyone talk about, is how he adjusted to the advent of the click track, and whether that was any challenge for him or whether that was just something he moved into without a problem. But people forget the extent to which all the stuff, you know, in the 60s and certain into the 70s was recorded without a click. And it meant that the sense of time itself was created entirely by, you know, the musicians in the room, and that Keith and I would say that the thing of Keith and Charlie particularly pulling and pushing at each other for the tempo and time is a lot of what makes the Stones. And I also wonder whether, you know, introducing a click could destroy that too. It seems like it never did, but it seems perilous to me.
We were talking before about Al Jackson Jr., who, you know, to me, like, he and Charlie are the rock drummers, and they both had that sense of like their timekeeping was so different from anybody else's. And that's why, I mean, it's a weird thing with the Stones that, you know, there's some songs people cover, but it's weird how rare, you know, people will cover a Stone song, not as a tribute, but trying to do the song. A lot of it's just because the Charlie stuff is just not duplicable. And But like he and Al Jackson, like they almost had, you can always tell it's them just in terms of how they are keeping the time. And it's like to imagine Charlie with a click track is almost obscene.
You know, something that keeps coming to mind, that, you know, that story that keeps circulating about Charlie sort of like, you know, punching Mick and like, you know, I'm not your drummer, you're my singer, that whole thing. It's very interesting because it's like that seems to be him in almost like a Ginger Baker kind of way, asserting like, no, I'm the guy or something. It's almost this macho gesture. But then the playing is it's like he had a sense of himself and a sense of his importance, but that manifested not in like a macho way, but in kind of like I'm going to lay back way, if that makes any sense. It's an odd story because it doesn't reflect like what we know of his playing.
That's right. And he really emphasized that, you know, there was a period of his life, and, you know, I think it's for anyone, it's a little bit of a cautionary tale that he had a period in his 40s when all of a sudden he developed a drug and alcohol problem. It's a reminder that you're never too old to screw your life up for a while out of nowhere. So I've always found that a chilling bit. But, it was out of character. He was drunk, and it was during a period when he was so – I feel like people have perhaps been harping on that a bit too much because he himself said it was out of character. However, don't annoy him, which fair enough.
I think that's why it's a story that people love, because it's out of character. I mean – nobody would tell a story like that about Keith Moon because it happened 3 or 4 times a day. Whereas with Charlie, it's the detail that makes it a great story, that's why people harp way too much on this story, is the detail of him putting on a suit in order to do it, that he gets out of bed and dresses up in a suit to go upstairs and punch the singer. That's the distinctive Charlie touch that makes it a Charlie story.
To be fair, I'm sure if he had to, go down to get an envelope from the front desk, he would have dressed the same way. So I'm not sure, I did want to say just a very basic thing, which is, I do remember I saw the Stones for the first time in, I think, 1994. And when I did, what I was really struck by was the number of people actually dancing. Because in all the rock shows and stuff I had been to at that point, no one was dancing like that. You didn't dance at a Who concert. Good luck. Even without Keith Moon, good luck. So but the extent to which it returned rock to that, or they never had to return because it had always been there, but it was that primal thing of it being dance music. And it just was such a reminder to me. It's like, oh, right, that's the thing, and it's still actually, but it's more unusual than you'd think. I just think it's kind of an essential point.
It's a fantastic point. And also, I know, again, our Corey Groh just talked to Lars Ulrich, who mentioned, the idea that it was Charlie that was making Mick dance as well. And when you see that incredible physicality, that's coming from that kind of circuit, right, from Charlie. But I think also that, to your point about dance music, I think that Charlie Watts represents this common root of all this popular music. Like, we think about jazz and rock as sort of like these, bifurcated things or whatever, but it's like Charlie's coming out of a time when jazz was dance music as well. That's the role of the drummer for him. It's like making people move. And these distinctions between these styles are fairly irrelevant when you get to the point of a Charlie Watts. And I think that I wonder how many more drummers out there are where that all those are so converged in one person, aside from, a Ringo or something like that. Like, we're really getting to the end of that generation where all that stuff was so commonly linked.
I mean, look, we were lucky enough for many years, for decades after the Beatles broke up, for decades and decades, you could go and see the Rolling Stones. Like, sure, Bill Wyman wasn't there, Brian Jones wasn't there either, but it still was the Stones. As long as Charlie was there, you could pretty much say that you saw this thing that had changed the world, that it was right in front of your eyes. And that, while I kind of hope that they still do play, and I think they'll be great with Steve Jordan, but it won't be that Stones. And I think we were really lucky, those of us who were born a little later, that we got to see that. And I think that's part of, as much as we're mourning for Charlie in particular, it's also hard not to mourn that connection to the original thing.
Yeah, and he never lost that. And even if you went to see, it turns out the Stones shows from the summer of 2019, those were the last Stone shows. So I was thinking about the last time I ever saw Charlie play with the Stones. I was like, God, that was like his last show ever. It was just a couple weeks later. Him playing Honky Tonk Women, another great example of a song that is barely a song, except it's just Charlie, do your thing and we'll fill in the parts around you. And that's basically what Honky Tonk Women is. And when Charlie was playing that song, it never reached a point where people were sitting back and going, oh, I remember this one. This brings back fond memories. Like, it was a, get up and move song. And Charlie took pride in that. He cared deeply about that, that ethic. And like you said, making Mick dance, and making sure everybody was dancing to that one. He never surrendered an inch of that.
Yeah. And I think watching that, that Shine a Light thing, somehow this incredibly, band of incredibly old guys, the show still feels like wild. It still feels like this weird, wired edge to it. And that is Mick, sure. And that is Keith, sure. But, again, where is that pulse of that coming from? You know what I mean? Like, you're saying it doesn't feel like an oldies show, somehow. And that has to have something to do with Charlie, right?
Yeah. And because we've been talking about, the Beatles and Ringo, you go see Ringo and his all-star band, and Ringo is drumming and drumming fantastically for a large part of the show. And when he's not drumming, he's up and dancing. he's, you know, and something about, I don't know what it is. These drummers, they age like so gracefully because they don't lose touch with the physicality and the vitality of it. And that sense of rhythm. I mean, it's really amazing. Like how we're seeing this age of drummers just fantastically aging with just almost insane reserves of vitality. But Charlie Watts, absolutely that. Never lost the stroke.
Thanks so much to Rob Sheffield and Hank Steamer. That was our show for today. We tried to do a little bit of justice to the great Charlie Watts, sending thoughts out to his family and to his bandmates, to fans everywhere. And that's our show for today. Rolling Stone Music Now will be back next week here on SiriusXM Volume Channel 106. In the meantime, we are, of course, a podcast. Download Rolling Stone Music Now wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Please leave us a nice review on Apple Podcasts if you can. That truly is always appreciated. But as always, thanks for listening. Stay safe, and we'll see you next week.